You're listening to episode 358 of the New World Order. My name is Klaatu, and in this episode, we're going to talk about Groff. G-R-O-F-F, that is the new version of Trough. T-R-O-F-F. We'll get to that after a little bit of listener email. So, I got an email from Bernard, I think it was. Yep, Bernard. And he says that he's glad that it's great, in fact, that I have a use for GPhoto 2, but he personally found it too cumbersome. He uses now a nifty little program called Simple MTPFS, which mounts the Android mobile, so you can use it just like any other USB device. I don't know if it can be found in the repos of your favorite distribution. Bernard is on Manjaro, and he got it from AUR. Which AUR is sort of the Slack builds of the Arch / Manjaro world. The project source code can be found on github.com/Fatina, that's PHATINA/simple-mtpfs. Greetings from Sweden. Thanks, Bernard. Great tip. This is a cool little application. I checked it out upon his recommendation. It is not in the Slack builds, and I didn't think to look for it anywhere else, like on my work laptop or anything, but I just downloaded the source code because it seemed pretty easy to compile and to get running. At least that's what the GitHub readme made it sort of seem like. It generally speaking is pretty easy to get going, but there are a couple of notes that I guess I'll mention, because there are some steps that are not listed in the README file. You probably would have figured out the steps, especially if you've heard this I think I did an episode, maybe it was a Hacker Public Radio episode, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, about auto tools. And if you know how to use auto tools, then you'll figure it out. It's not too hard. But if you don't, or if you just don't think about it, because the instructions on the GitHub README are pretty explicit, it says do these steps. And so you might think, okay, well, those are the steps I need to do. And you'd be kind of wrong, because you need more to do more steps than what they say. So here's what we'll do. I will go to the terminal and see if I can get to where I downloaded this thing. I better make a directory called, I don't have to do that. I'm going to move simplemtfs.tar.gz into a little folder here. Okay, so I've got simple-mtpfs downloaded 0.3.0. That's the version that I've downloaded. That's the latest release. The GitHub is a little bit deceptive. If you go there, you might think, if you're looking at the dates and the sort of the apparent activity of the project page, you might get a little bit concerned about sort of the most recent major activity seems to be a bunch of, like 4 years ago, 6 years ago. There was 1 year, 5 months ago, however. And that is the latest commit as of the recording right now, about 5 or 6 months ago. January 6th is what the date is. And I'm not too concerned about that, because I figure my feeling on that subject is that if something is working, then there doesn't need to be a bunch of frivolous activity on their repository page. I remember for a while, SourceForge, during the worst parts of their downfall, they started doing weird things like making arbitrary updates, it seemed, to projects. And I seem to recall a statement by them saying that they did that so that people wouldn't think projects were abandoned or something weird like that. I probably shouldn't say that without finding a reference, but I do remember there being some unusual activities on SourceForge where it would say that something has been, recently updated, and you'd look at it and it wasn't really recently updated. It was very strange. So I think there's a little bit of a danger to start falling into this trap of, oh, this repository, the source code, the homepage of the source code isn't active enough, so therefore, I guess the project's dead. I mean, if you go to slackware.com and look at the front page of that, you would assume that the project was dead. And it's just not a good sort of measure of the health of a project, I don't think. So, you go to the page, you go to the releases, there's a 0.3.0 version, you download that, and then you tar it, so tar xvf simple mtfs - simple mtpfs - 0.3.0.tar.gz, that did it. Now, according to the build instructions, all I have to do is make a directory, and they call it build. That's too much typing for me. I'm just going to call it B. And then cd in the B, and then dot dot slash to get back one level, so back into that main place. Configure. Well, it says no such file or directory. So what's happening here is that we need to set up the project, the automake infrastructure here. So go back into the main root directory of the project, the main project directory, and you'll want to do auto reconf dash dash install dash dash verbose. And that generates a couple of different files. It generates the configure.ac and things like that. And then you can make your build directory, whatever you want to call it. I just call it B for short, and then dot dot slash configure. And this time it should configure correctly. Yep, there it goes. It has configured correctly. It tells me that the prefix is going to be user local, which is fine for now. Temp directory is temp. That's fine. It knows where the USB bus is because we've got libusb installed. I have the fuse file system thing installed, and I forget what the other dependency. Oh, C++11. That was the other one, and that's fine. So yeah, that's all done. Now we can type make. We could give it, I don't know, 6 jobs, or well, let's do 4 jobs. It compiles the software, finishes. It's got a couple of warnings in here, something about a zero size array. So a couple of minor issues, but nothing to be too concerned about, I don't think. And then you can install it. So I'm not going to install it directly because I'm on Slackware and I don't have to do things like that. I can just make a package out of it exactly from its source directory. So I'll make a directory in my slash temp directory, slash tmp. And I'll call it simple dash mtpfs dash 0.3.0 dash x86 underscore 64 dash 1 because it's the first time I've built this package. Actually, it's not. Sorry, I'm lying to you. It's actually dash 2 because I built it before I recorded this episode. And then underscore smi, which is the tag that I use for slackermedia.info. So that now exists, and I should be able to do a make install, and then all in capital letters, DESTDIR equals slash temp slash simple mtpfs blah 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 dash 2 underscore smi. And that's a very quick process. Then I can change directory to my little build folder in temp, or my destination folder in temp. I'll do an ls here. And it looks like there is a local, a user local file structure. There's a bin directory where the command is found, and there's a share directory where the man page is found, which is weird because I don't remember finding a man page for this, but that's fine. I guess maybe I should have changed the man path probably. Either way, it's there. I can do a sudo slash sbin make pkg dash ly dash cn, and then I'll tell it where I want to save the file that I'm creating, and I'm just going to put it back into slash tmp, so slash tmp, and then I'll give it the same exact name, simple dash mtfs and so on, but I'll end that with txz. Press return. Oh, I don't need this sudo for that, I don't think, actually. Anyway, and then I'll do a sudo slash sbin install pkg simple mt slash tmp slash simple and so on. I'm not going to actually do that because I've already got it installed. Now I could upgrade it or something, but I'm not going to. So that was the install process. Pretty straightforward, all told. I mean, if it wasn't for that extra auto reconf step that they don't mention on the README page, it would have been exactly as stated on the README page, combined with sort of the usual Slackware make package magic. I really wanted to say the word magic there, and I was trying to get it in at every turn. The make package magic that just takes a folder with a file structure in it and makes it into a Slackware package. It's very, very useful. This is one of the reasons I love Slackware so much, is because of that process right there. Okay, so it's installed. What do we do with it? Well, turns out it's, I guess, maybe superficially similar to GPhoto 2 in a way, at least the workflow is. So simple-mtpfs-list-devices. Now, oh, my phone is not on right now. Okay, I'm going to need to have that on. But anyway, I'll talk about this list devices command while I start this thing up. So the --list-devices probes your USB ports for an MTP device. If it finds one or more, it prints those devices to your terminal. And in this case, speaking from previous experience, you do that and you get one colon and then the name of your device, or yeah, a string representing your device, and the category of your device. Interestingly, the string that it gave me back was the exact same string as GPhoto, which kind of made me wonder if this was hooking into libgphoto. And if you do a LDD on simple mtpfs, it doesn't seem like it is. What it is hooking into is libmtp, which I didn't even know I had on my system. But there you go. That's probably where it's getting those names. I could be wrong. It could be something else. But that's kind of my guess. I didn't really look into all of the possible. I mean, I figure it could either be libmtp. I guess maybe it could be libusb, but it could also be like libfuse or something. Who knows? Or even udev, for all I know. I'm really just not sure where what component of either libgphoto2 or this one is responsible for finding that string, that very recognizable string. It also could be that it's a recognizable string because it is being broadcast from the phone itself. That could be sort of the reason, and that's just the obvious thing. Like when you're probing for a device, the thing that you get back, you know, is generated by the device. So maybe that's why I'm recognizing it. I'm not sure. Okay, so my phone is back on in real life. And we're going to do the next step, which is, so I've got my device listed. Now the next step, according to simple-mtpfs-help, it does suggest that I need to look at a device and then mount it at some location on my hard drive. So I'm gonna attempt to do that. And the first time I attempted to do that, I just did exactly what I guess what you might think one would do according to the help, and that is simple-mtpfs-device, quote, 1:// Samsung Galaxy models, MTP, close quote, --verbose/mount/floppy, or wherever. I put it in floppy because I figured I won't forget that it's in floppy, because what else do I use that for? Which the answer is actually quite a lot. I use it for a lot because I think, oh, I'll never use that, so I always use it. Okay, and it tells me 2020.06.11 error, cannot mount the device to mount floppy. So the reason for that is because I don't have the permissions that I need to do that as a user. So if I do that as sudo, then it tells me a little bit more information. And I should add, actually, that I added the --verbose flag. Without the verbose flag, it fails silently, which is not usually the expectation on Unix. Usually you succeed silently and fail verbosely. So you really do have to add that verbose flag because you're not going to hear from it otherwise. Okay, so now that it's failed, and it's failed with sudo permissions, it has attempted to contact my phone. And in fact, if I look at my phone screen, there's a message on it saying allow access to phone data. The connected devices will be able to access data on this phone. So I'll click allow, and then I will turn back to mtpfs and run the exact same command. So that's the sudo simple-mtpfs --device, quote 1:, name of the phone, name of the protocol, or you know, the exact string that was given me after --list-devices, --verbose/mnt/floppy. Hit return, and it takes over my prompt. So that was another thing that I didn't quite expect. I thought it would be more like, well, the mount command, I guess, where it gives you back your prompt after it does the thing that you told it to do. But it actually dominates the prompt. So that terminal's used. But I'll just open another tab here in console and do an ls of slash mnt slash floppy, and it says that permission is denied. So obviously I need to work on what users can access this stuff, because that's not really working out for me so well. But I do see that there are two locations listed in floppy now. One is card and one is phone. And if I do an ls on card, I see files there that are recognizable to me as things that I have on the SD card in the phone. And if I do an ls on the phone, I see files that I actually put there with Gphoto. So those are very recognizable to me. I remember putting those on last episode. So there you go. And that's simple MTPFS in the, I guess, simplest of demonstrations. I mean, that's how much I've used this application so far. Pretty much as long as it's taken me to explain it here is exactly the amount of time I spent on it before pressing record on this episode. So I've not used it in real life. I've not used it to copy data over. Basically, I just wanted to see it working because Bernard was recommending it. So I thought, okay, I'll try that. And yeah, it looks pretty good. I can see the appeal of this. I can see why someone would prefer this over Gphoto 2. For instance, Gphoto 2 feels a little FTP-ish. You know what I mean? Like, it's a little bit like, you know that device is out there, and you know there are locations on the device, and you can kind of probe it for some information, and it'll get you some, it'll list some things for you, but it has to be in a certain exact right place, and so on. This is like Bernard said in his email, this is like any other USB device. This might as well be a hard drive. And that's a nice convenience. That's quite nice. I would need to work on permissions to make sure that I'm actually able to interface with it as a plain old user. And it's a nice little feature. I think I imagine it could be useful. And I say I imagine because I'm not going to use this. This isn't my workflow. And I completely understand why Gphoto 2 wouldn't be someone's workflow. I do feel maybe like that's the abnormal choice. But for what I do put onto a phone, onto a mobile device, Gphoto 2 that's exactly my workflow. I've collected things on a computer, and then I suddenly realize I really want to have this on the phone so that I can look at it later today when I'm out, or I want to listen to this podcast or this demonstrator, this talk from a conference. I'll put it on my phone because I've grabbed it with YouTube-DL or something, and I've converted it to sound only, or rather I've just grabbed the sound from YouTube-DL, and I want to listen to it later as a podcast. Slap it on the device, and that's just kind of what I do. And then I delete it from the device itself, and that's kind of the workflow. And sometimes, on the rare occasion, I'll download something on the phone and need to get that over to my computer, and I can either use Gphoto 2, or more likely, I'll just use the Share to Computer Android app that I think I briefly mentioned in the previous episode. I don't see myself using simple MTPFS. It's almost too much. It's more than I need, in a way. But I can totally see how, in a different situation, I would absolutely love this, because when you have a device that plugs into the USB port of your computer, I think it is a completely reasonable expectation, if the device has storage on it already, that you would be able to interface with the storage that you find there just like any other device. I don't think that that's an unreasonable expectation, and I think it's a huge failing of mobile devices, as I said in the previous episode, that it needs to be this complex. I really dislike that. I don't like that it is clunky in this way, but that's where we are, and I guess these are great workarounds. If that's a silver lining, I guess that's great. Either way, I do, just for the record, I think we could do better. I think we could do better mobile devices. I think we could do better in lots of different ways. Now, we should talk about Groff. But trust me, you're going to want a cup of coffee for this. I have a lot to say. I'm going to need a cup of coffee. Let's break, come back, talk about Groff. Coffee has been acquired. I hope that you've acquired coffee for yourself as well. Let's talk about Groff. I'm not going to give you a history lesson of Groff or Trough because I don't know that much about it. And if I told you anything about it, I would just be reading something off of Wikipedia, and I don't feel like that's worth me doing. You can look that up yourself. I didn't bother looking it up. It calls itself a document formatting system. And that is kind of an important principle to understand, is that Groff is both the command and the format, or the syntax, if you will. And here's the thing about the Groff, or I guess technically the Trough format. It is horrible. Nobody likes it. It's ugly, it's clunky, it isn't intuitive, it can be, it's difficult to read, it's not something that's very easy to remember. There are just lots and lots of reasons why you might look at Groff, Trough, whatever, and think, well, this is an archaic format, and no one should be using it in the modern world. We have so many better tools for doing this thing. And indeed, we truly do. We have lots of tools to essentially produce the same kinds of results as what you get out of Groff. I mean, to name a few, DocBook, ASCII doc, that's two. I was gonna say Common Mark or Markdown, but I feel like I always say those and then have to tell you why I don't actually like them, but that I use them on a daily basis. So there are better tools though. Now, here's the thing about those tools though, and this is why you might actually think, oh, LaTeX, that's another one. You might actually think Groff has certain attributes to it that maybe are advantageous. The fact about those tools is they require a pretty hefty tool chain underneath them. I mean, not to produce them, and that's pretty cool. To produce those things, it's pretty lightweight. It's you need a text editor, and you just need to kind of remember how they work. You can do that. That's pretty easy. I mean, especially something like Common Mark, that's really easy to remember. ASCII doc, RST, that sort of thing, that's a little bit tougher. They've got a little bit more specialized syntax thrown in there. But, you know, if you're working on something that requires specialized syntax, then maybe that's just the price that you have to pay. DocBook, potentially a lot more complex, depending on I guess, how often you use it. And, even if you use it a lot, I mean, there's a lot of tags in there. I mean, I use DocBook also on a daily basis, and I keep the DocBook manual on my little e-reader, my inkbook, and I look at it when I am not sure about a tag. I look for it for the inheritance and the child elements and the valid parent elements and all that stuff. So making them is pretty easy as long as you sort of remember how to do them, but then you have to, you know, if you want the output that you want to get it out of that markup or markdown language into whatever your actual delivery mode is, and that usually does take a robust tool set. It depends. Again, there's a caveat here. There's always, there's caveats to everything, but there's, you know, if all you're trying to do is transfer it to, I don't know, HTML, maybe that's not such a big tool set. Like for Markdown, for instance, you could get a Markdown to HTML converter pretty easily. I think, in fact, if memory serves, the original Markdown command, the Perl script, is for Markdown to HTML. I mean, that was the default expectation, was people will be going out to HTML. And that's why, to this day, you can insert HTML into your Markdown document and have a valid Markdown document. It's completely integrated and considered fairly normal. I mean, frankly, it's practically essential in some cases. So you can get rather lightweight. But if you think, well, I want to go out to HTML, I want to go out to EPUB, I want to go out to PDF, I want to go out to plain text, you're starting to look at a tool set that starts to get a little bit Heftier. And by heftier, I could mean like a gigabyte of Haskell libraries that you might have to download and compile. I might mean for DocBook, an XSLT processor and a potentially several different tools to convert your output into some other format, like FOP to go out to PDF. With LaTeX, you might need a PDF engine to go out to PDF. You might need, I don't know, something else for EPUB. I've never gone from LaTeX to EPUB before. Don't know much about it. So there's an inherent, or there's a debt there that you have to pay eventually of a specific tool chain, possibly schemas, different engines, whatever. It can get complex. Groff, if you look at it, if you don't look at it too hard, it's a pretty, I don't want to say self-contained, but it's the tool chain is pretty simple. You get Groff, and now you have the tool set. Now, granted, if you want to go out to a bunch of different formats, you're going to need different macros and some extra bits that you'll have to cobble together. But on the whole, I feel like certainly if you sat me down and said, okay, you've got 2 hours to install a tool chain for a robust documentation system, and you gave me the choice between Pandoc and Groff, I would take Groff in a heartbeat. Because Pandoc, I don't even know if you can compile all of the different Haskell libraries that you need to end up with a valid Pandoc installation in 2 hours. It's that much is required for Pandoc. DocBook, I might be able to, I could probably swing that one potentially. That said, I've never compiled FOP or assembled FOP from source. I always just download the jar file that they provide or whatever it is. It might not even be a jar file, but it's already compiled. It's all ready to go. So I wouldn't swear to that one. But Groff, it's kind of elegant in a weird way. And I don't mean the format. I just mean the tool chain. Okay, so that's what I had to say about Groff, really. I mean, in terms of sort of why would you look at Groff? Well, that's potentially why. You might look at Groff because you don't want to have to worry about very elaborate systems that will process the text that you are ostensibly trying to simplify it for yourself. Okay, so Groff, what does it do? Well, it reads lines of text, and the primary function of it is to collect words, strings from your input, and fill the lines of this, each line with those words. It justifies those words to the right-hand margin by inserting extra spaces in the line to account for, to meet that margin, and then it outputs that result. So if you gave it a file that says hello and hard return or character return, whatever that's called, line break, world, and then you sent that through Groff, then you would end up with a line that read hello world, all in one line. Now, you know how back in like HTML1 days there were, and I've never actually used HTML1 to my knowledge, but let's pretend like I had. And so some of this might be a little bit wrong, but back in those days, you would be able to, you have a tag, right? And you do a paragraph tag. You'd open that tag, p, and you'd write your sentence hello world, and then you might think to yourself, and I don't even think you had to necessarily close that tag if I'm remembering correctly. I think you could, maybe that was a quirks mode, but I think you could just leave all your tags pretty much dangling. And then you might decide, well, what if I wanted world to be bold, emboldened? So you might go back and you get the p tag and it says hello, and then you might put a b tag for bold in front of world, and then you close it, I guess, after world. And then when you looked at that text in a browser, you would notice that hello was one font face, and world was a slightly different font face, and that was pretty neat. Well, that's kind of the method that you might use in Groff, except instead of p tag for paragraph and b tag, and so you do dot ft, which I imagine stands for font. I wasn't really able to tell or to find a great reference for what all of these little abbreviations meant. Sometimes the GNU manual sort of spells it out, and then other times it kind of skips over what it means. But the .ft request is what it's called, and then the argument to that request is some other thing. So if, in other words, you might do hello and then .ft capital I, no, we want bold, right? So capital B for bold, and then next line, world. Now you have created a sentence that starts out with the word hello in its normal Roman font face. It's what they call it, Roman, .ft. R would be for Roman, I for italic, B for bold, and then world would be on the same line, and it would be in bold. And that is kind of the typical syntax for graph commands, or as they're called, requests. Not all requests, as far as I know, necessarily, well, no, I should say not all requests require an argument. So, for instance, you could say, you could do a .sp, for instance, and that would create output when you encounter several lines. They would be spaced, single spaced. Let's say you wanted them to be double spaced, then you would do .sp space 2, and that would space things every other line. You could do .sp3, and that would be whatever that's called. I don't know what it's called after double space. I've never seen anyone do that before. But you could do that, and that's a request, and then there's an argument. So many of the requests are happy to take a request without an argument. They have some kind of default argument, I guess, sort of set in, and others require some argument for more information, and then some don't need an argument at all. For instance, .bp is a page break or a break page request, and as far as I know, there's no argument either required or even permitted for the BP. I could be wrong. Again, I had a really hard time finding. Maybe I just didn't know what to look for. But I was not able to find a really good kind of master list of all the requests. So, oh, and actually, it looks like I'm looking at my reference here. It looks like .sp1.5i would be a further argument that you could say 1.5 inches per line. So that can space each line by a certain measurement rather than by line count. That's kind of interesting. That's probably good for, I guess for layout. I was thinking of like a title page maybe, where you want sort of maybe the title and the author and, you know, I don't know, the publication date or something. You kind of want it all spaced out in a certain way. So that's the format. You've got text, and then you've got these special things that you can insert into your text, and you can kind of consider them as commands, or again, they're actually called requests. And to me, that kind of strikes me a little bit, it kind of feels like HTML in a way, but it also kind of feels like LaTeX from what I've seen of LaTeX, because I have noticed in LaTeX documents a lot of times there's like a lot of, yeah, sort of structure in the text file about formatting and that reminds me of this. Okay, so here's I guess a partial list of some of the requests, or macros, as they appear to be called as well. I guess the macro is the thing that provides the request, probably. So there are macros, for instance, .th for a title of a specific title heading, I guess must be what it stands for. Again, they don't really seem to give the mnemonic for what it is. They hint around it, but they don't exactly spell it out. So .th, I'm assuming title heading, possibly. You can set the title of the man page to a title, and or the title of a section to a section, which must have a value between 1 and 8. The value of section may also have a string appended, for instance, .pm, to indicate a specific subsection of the man page. .sh is to set up an unnumbered section as a heading for an unnumbered section. That's .sh. There is also .ss, which is just a heading. So that's the unnumbered subsection, SS, heading. .tp is an indented paragraph with a label. That's important. This is, you'll see this in man pages a lot. Now I won't be able to find it. No, actually you can. If we even just go to mangrof, you'll find, for instance, anything where it's saying dash, you know, where it's giving you an option, dash D, R, set default input encoding, that's what they're, well, actually, that one, no, that is, I think that's one of them. Dash E, pre-processed with EQN, that's definitely one of them. The label, or the, what do they call it, .tp, indented with label, yeah. So the label is .e, and then the paragraph itself is indented, and it's the actual, in this case, the explanation. So the, you can think of it as a key and a value almost, maybe. You know, the dash E is the, I guess, key, and the preprocess with EQN is the value. That didn't actually work out quite as well as I thought it would. But yeah, that's a very common thing in man pages, because you've got the thing that they're telling you about, and then the thing that, and then the explanation of that thing. Let's see. There's a bunch of other stuff. I could go on and on, but I mean, there really is just a bunch of different dot two letters and then some argument. And this is a great list of macros. It, like I say, it doesn't exactly tell you how to remember any of them. That you're just gonna have to sort of remember that yourself, and that can be difficult sometimes. I have found. But aside from that, it is a good list of the things that you can do with Grof, and it goes on for a while. There's a good number of options here, and this is good for the screen, and it's good for printing, amazingly. And I think that's kind of one of the most surprising things about this is that it can go to both. It, you know, because I think of Grof as a man page format. That's kind of what I've. It's always the format that I've heard it. Being referenced as you have man page, you do it with Grof. I mean, that's what it's for. I just kind of thought that was all it was for. I didn't exactly realize it was specifically like one of its targets. You know, is a printer, is a PostScript file, DVI file, that sort of thing. So it's not uncommon for this to actually be used, at least in theory, or maybe at one point. To have that formatted for printing. And there are lots of different options to set your page size and your margin size and so on. So for instance, get to the macro page here. The dash nr is the method that you would use to set the margin. And you could do, for instance, a top margin, dot nr, capital H, capital M, I think that's header margin, 1.5i, that's for 1.5 inches. If you work in centimeters, you could replace the I with a C, although you'd probably want to make it more like, I don't know, 5C instead of 1.5I, or whatever it would be, 5, 4, whatever it would be. And then you can do the footer margin as well for the with FM, so that would be .nr, FM, and then, you know, 5C or whatever you wanted to set that to. So you can set this stuff for your page. It is rather absolute. I don't know of a way to make it relative. So if you're printing this on an A4 size paper versus an A5 or A6 size paper, as far as I know, your margins are going to be the same across both sizes. That seems like a weakness to me for sure. But it is something that you could do. Okay, let's see. So let's talk a little bit about how one gets something that you've written in Grof out of Grof and into something else. I happen to have a man page here written in Grof. You can find lots of these yourself all over your system. They're usually in your user/share/man or user man or wherever you keep your man pages. There's a bunch of them there. So if you want to take a look at a graph document, you've got lots to choose from. Now, there are more modern sort of methods for generating man pages. You don't have to do it in graph. I mean, I think they end up in graph no matter what. I could be slightly wrong about that. But like Mandoc, I think, is Mandoc. I think that's a rather relatively modern way of writing man pages. But the traditional way is with this graph thing, and it is much as I've described. You type it into a text editor. You can view it once it exists. You can use a handy little graph viewer. It's called Man. So, for instance, if you wanted to, let's say I've got an application called Sport, and I've written a man page for it. So man.slash/sport.8. The man page doesn't necessarily have to find everything in the man path. You can point it to a file. Now you can also get, I mean, less will also render a graph file as like, sort of like the desired output. It'll actually render the graph in text. It won't look like graph, which is nice. If that's what you want. If you're trying to see graph in something that's kind of annoying, the only other way really is to either open it up in a text editor or just cat will show you the unrendered text. And if you look at the unrendered text, you see all of the of any man page pretty much. You'll see those requests, and maybe sometimes you'll see an argument to a request and so on. So you can see exactly what you're looking for. Like it is like HTML in the sense that, again, back in those early days of HTML, when you could actually just teach yourself HTML by looking at anybody else's web page and you could kind of reverse engineer it. That I do kind of feel like that's how graph is. It's a little bit clunky because there a lot of those macros, a lot of those requests don't make any good sense. What's the difference between a .sh and a .pp and a .tp and a .th? What does all that mean? Very difficult to kind of understand what you are doing, but then again, maybe you don't care. Maybe all you want is a specific output, and as long as you can mimic that's enough for you. For man pages especially, I kind of feel like 9 times out of 10, 8 times out of 10, that's probably enough. However, as I've said, there are other output formats. This isn't just for man pages, and there's a command on, I'm assuming this comes with the graph package. I guess I ought to look really quick just to make sure. Yes, it does. So this is called Grapher, Grofffer, and there are lots of commands that come with graph, and we're not going to get to all of them today, certainly. And I don't know how many we're going to cover. I mean, we'll cover all of them in some way, but there are a lot there. But I do want to talk about Grapher because it is a very neat and convenient one. So Grapher, looking at the man page, displays graph files and man pages on X and your TTY. It says the Grapher program is the easiest way to use graph. It can display arbitrary documents written in graph language or other RAF languages that are compatible to the original TROF language. It finds and runs all the necessary graph preprocessors so that you don't have to. And that is truly, truly useful. So for instance, if I just type in grapher and then dot slash sport dot eight, that's the name of the man page I want to view. If I hit return, it opens up Ocular for me and shows me a PDF render of the man page that I was hoping to view. And that's pretty cool. I mean, I could print right out of there. That's a printable document, no problem. Let's try something else. Let's do grapher, and then we'll look in our man path. User man, I don't know, man one. Ansible dash, no, like Ansible.1.gz. Once again, it finds everything that it needs to find in order for this to work, and it displays Ansible.1.pdf for me in Ocular. And it's quite well formatted. It's got all the page numbers that it needs to have. It looks very nice. I can print that off without a problem. Super easy. Postscript done. So That's pretty fancy. That's a really nice feature of Grof, or rather, I should say, it's a really nice utility Grofer is. The other utility that comes with Grof that is, directly related to what we're doing is the actual Grof command, and it's a little bit more complex because it wants you to find all of the preprocessors yourself, and that can be sometimes a little bit daunting. But in the devices section of the man page of Grof, it shows you the different, essentially the output destinations of whatever it is you're processing, and that is useful. So you've got a couple of different targets that you might want to output to. You have ASCII for your plain text, DVI for a text DVI format. I don't use that, but I know some people know text quite well. HTML for HTML output. I'm skipping over some here, but there's PostScript, there's PDF, UTF-8 text, and XHTML. That's seven useful output formats right there. And I've skipped over a couple of them, and it all just kind of comes with Grof. This is stuff that you get more or less for free when you're installing Grof. So that's kind of a powerful aspect of Grof, which again I think is one of the arguments for Grof. But let's go through a document from start to finish. I mean, creating a document from start to finish just to get kind of a feel for the workflow. I think that's very frequently a useful technique. So we'll create a document here in Emacs and we'll call it temp.1. I'm going to invoke the inrof mode, so that's just Alt X inrof dash mode. That puts me into the correct mode for syntax highlighting and so on. And we know that the first line needs, or we can expect that the first line ought to be a dot th. And we know that because the first macro mentioned in this section 4.1.2 in the GNU manual for Grof says that that's the title section. It sets the title of the man page to title and the section to section, which must have a value of 1 through 8. Okay, so we can do this with a dot th, and we'll give it the title example. And I'm going to quote that just to be safe. Example and section number, we'll give it 1 because my example file is going to be in a man.1 for no good reason. It could be .2, it could be dot, or rather, it could be 8, it could be whatever. I'm going to put 1. That corresponds to the man categorization. 1 being general commands, 2 being system calls, 3 being library functions, 4 being special files, 5 being file format, 6 are games, 7 is just miscellaneous, I think, and then 8 is sysadmin commands and possibly daemons or services, I guess you could say. So I'll just say it's 1 because why not? It's just an example. So kind of scrolling through here, we see that .th is the title. .sh is set up an unnumbered section heading sticking out to the left, versus a .ss, which is set up an unnumbered subsection heading. I don't feel like we're in subsection heading yet, so we're going to make an .sh, and we'll call that name, because it's pretty usual. It's pretty common for man pages to give you the name, print the name for you with a brief description. So we'll just type in example. This is, well, dash, this is an example Grof file. We'll do another section, .sh, called options. And now we need to come up with a way to do one of these fancy kind of like, give the reader the option and then explain to them what the option does, that kind of thing. And I think what I've been using for that myself is a .tp, but you can also do .ip for indented paragraph. But I think TP, if I'm, yeah, set up TP does the indented paragraph with a label. And so for options, I think that's typically what people use. So it's .tp, and then I'm gonna go to the next line because I can. And I'll do dash dash file. Now let's do dash dash option. Actually, you know what? We'll do dash dash flag. And then comma dash f. Okay, And then next line, I will call it, I'll say defines the input, or defines a flag. I can't type right now. Flag for this example command. And we could do that again, .tp dash dash option comma dash o defines an option for this example command. There, that's our document. It's got a th, an sh, another sh, a tp, and another tp. So now we're gonna drop doc out to our terminal, and we'll go into the source directory where I'm working first. Okay, there we go. And we'll just do a graph. Actually, let's do a less first, just to kind of troubleshoot this, make sure that we're on the right track. So I'm gonna do a less dot slash temp dot one. I get no errors. And I get a really nice pre-formatted kind of official looking header. It says example, and then parentheses one, close parentheses, general commands manual, example one. So I got all that for free, right? I didn't type in any of that. I just typed in that this was the name, the title was example, and the section was one. And it made it look very nice and official for me. And then the next line I've got is name. Example dash, this is an example graph file. And under that, I could have, you know, I think traditionally in man pages, you get like a little synopsis and you get maybe a description of what its intended use is for and so on. I didn't do any of that. I just go straight to options. And so I've got options here and it's nice and it's in bold. And I've got a dash dash flag, comma dash F. Defines a flag for this example, and so on. And you can look at existing man pages and look at how other people format their man pages and get the exact macros that they're using for specific use cases. This isn't necessarily the best format that I'm doing here. It's just one that I think is easy to read and easy to translate to different formats. But all the macros are here. There are more macros online, apparently. You can get more macros for these things. And it is pretty straightforward to use. It's plain text. It is a markup language. You're putting text into this document that you don't intend really to ever render. It's, there are special elements that are never to be rendered and rather affect the way that the thing is rendered. Okay, so now we're going to go back up over to the manual here. And there's a section called invocation. That section kind of gives you some idea of some of the common ways that you might invoke graph. Not grapher, but just graph. And it's got some okay examples. One of them is graph-t, which is calling a preprocessor. Dash mandoc, which I don't know if that's actually correct, dash, or at least for my use case, dash capital T ASCII. So capital T is the one that you really need to pay attention to. That's the device setting. So this is the output setting. By invoking dash capital T ASCII, we're telling it to translate our graph into ASCII text. And then we're giving it temp.1 because that's the file we wanted to look at. And if you press return after that, it gives you essentially a render of your graph, but without all of the pretty rendering. So it is just the ASCII text. If you pipe it through less at that point, then you do get the nice pretty render with all the bolded text, and that's really all I have. But if you were using something else, underlines or italics, then it would be able to do that for you. Another obvious output device, I guess, would be UTF-8. That ought to work just as well, and it does. And then let's even try, for instance, because we know from the man page that HTML was one of the targets. So if you do graph dash dash T, which again, that's a preprocessor. TBL is the preprocessor. Dash mandoc, I don't think that's actually required by any means. So let's drop that really quick. Yeah, that's good. Okay. So dash capital T HTML. So our device is going to be HTML temp one, and then we pipe it through less or not. We don't really have to. It spits it out as HTML, so less isn't going to really help us at all. And there it is. It's translated the man page into HTML. I guess what we could do is pipe it out to Conqueror. And then we would be able to see the HTML render in a web rendering engine. And it doesn't look like that worked. Nope, it did not work. Pipe it to LuaKit and see if that works better for me. No, it doesn't. I guess these things don't take input that way. That's fine. We'll skip that. I'll bet you anything links would do it. Surely that's got to take input from a pipe. No, it doesn't. It doesn't appear that it does. Okay, well, I could redirect that to a file, obviously, and then open it in a browser, and then I would get the satisfaction of seeing the rendered HTML. But it's not that important to me. We've seen the HTML code, and that's what I really wanted to demonstrate. And then for other output devices, you just want to look at the dash T option. Dash T space dev is how I find it most useful to search in the man page. You get the one at the top, and then you get the one in the options. That is Groff and Groffer. And I think more importantly, that's sort of the general workflow of those. You can see kind of how easy it is to write some text and to translate it pretty quickly into a couple of different formats. Is this the most flexible system ever? Probably not. It seems to, at least the version that comes shipped on Slackware and I think on most Linux systems, is geared pretty heavily towards man pages. It is a technical format. It's not really something that you would want to necessarily do your typesetting for that book of poetry that you have coming out, or even a novel probably. But certainly it's something for man pages, and if you are looking for a simple, well, relatively simple formatting system for any content, but you want that lightweight tool chain, then Groff may well be something to look at. Not something I'm going to look at anytime soon myself. I'm simply saying I think that is a niche that it can occupy if that's what you want to use it for. And aside from that, I don't know why you would want to use it. I mean, if it's not for the lightweight tool chain and it's not for the man pages, I'm not sure what the appeal to Groff would be. That said, maybe there's stuff that I'm not thinking about. For instance, is the predictability of all of the tags involved with Groff, I could see it making scripting relatively liberating. You could really probably find a lot of, you could probably manipulate things pretty quickly with scripts just because you know exactly the commands, the requests, the macros that you're looking for. So maybe that, I don't know, maybe there's some strength there. Who knows? There's a lot of escaping that you have to do in Groff too. I didn't really go over that, so that'll catch you out if you're not careful. And yeah, it's got quirks. It's different than what I think most of us are used to. But sometimes that's exactly what other people like about it. That's the kind of thing that makes something fun for some people. So check out Groff. Give it a go. See if you like it. See if it's useful to you. And if not, now you know it exists, you know generally what it's used for, and in the next episode we'll go over some of the other commands in that package. I'll talk to you next time. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is at Klaatu at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at Klaatu at member.fsf.org. That's Klaatu at member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, GNUWorldOrder.info and SlackerMedia.info. I will see you next time. You know, of course, that you are living in a parade.